ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Forging a new path is a powerful thing. It can also be daunting, because there's a comfort in knowing the elders you learn from have walked ahead, clearing the debris and smoothing the way. But sometimes, waiting isn't an option. Hello and welcome to Away, Indigenous Art and Culture on ABC Radio National. I'm Rudy Bremer. Alt rock band Selve have had an incredible year. They recorded their second album, Breaking Into Heaven, at the legendary Abbey Road Studios in London, released it in September, then brought those new sounds home with an Australian tour, including a live session right here in the Away studio. Today, you'll revisit my yarn with Selve bandmates Lockie Little and Reese Bowden to hear about the making of the album and how they've centred First Nations storytelling while writing music across three countries. Stay with me here on Away. For 94 years, Abbey Road Studios has been the home of artists who've shaped music and popular culture. And despite being the smallest of the original rooms in the repurposed London house, Studio 3 is the blueprint for the modern recording studio. Having unleashed 9 decades of groundbreaking music, it's a veritable playground for music makers. Still, there's never been a Blackfella recorded in the iconic studio. Until now. Selve are a 6-piece alt-rock band from the Gold Coast, and they've just released their second album, Breaking Into Heaven, which was recorded right there in Abbey Road's Studio 3. Selve are here in the Away studios to reflect on Breaking Into Heaven and the subversive energy of taking an Indigenous-led album developed on Jubby Jubby country all the way to England to be immortalised. Before we get into that, though, they're going to play live.
Myself myself again. Let me care.
Catch My Breath live on Radio National. And I'm sitting here with Jubby Jubby Man Lockie Little and Anawan Man Rhys Bowden. Along with Creation, Michael, Liam and Scott, they are Selve. And so, Lockie, I wonder if you can tell me a little about the song you just played.
So Catch My Breath was a song that we wrote while we were in France working on the album, and it's probably what the most like soft and soothing song on the entire album. Up until that point, there's a lot of rock, there's a lot of chaos going on, and it's really a kind of, you know, bad pun, but a breath of fresh air amidst it all. And it's kind of about being in a time of like extreme burnout and, you know, really trying to grasp for something, whether it's your goals and your dreams and wearing yourself out. It's not anyone else's kind of fault. It's your own, like, you know, sometimes we can be our worst boss in a certain degree. So the song's kind of about just like letting go of that and taking a moment to catch your breath before you do something stupid to or undermine yourself to get the thing that you're pursuing.
Yeah, it's very heartfelt, very, very tender song.
When I ask bands to come in, particularly bands like you guys that are really high energy, really like big sounds, and then ask you to do something that's quite stripped back and like how it feels to kind of strip away all of the elements, like the drums, the keys, and really rely and lean into vocals and guitar.
Well, we are also a lot of big softies. And the truth is that Catch My Breath, that is how Catch My Breath is. So it's just acoustic and vocals.
Yeah.
So it already has everything stripped back. So that was the perfect one to bring in.
I think Catch My Breath always has, from the moment that we started writing it, just felt vulnerable from the get-go. Like when we were writing it in France, we had all the band, but we had all our friends in there and we got everyone to like sing a little bit on it, even people that don't normally sing and stuff. And it was like, the creation of that song was a moment for everyone to step into a bit of vulnerability. So it's always been coded with that from the start, I'd say.
But it's fun as well because we put a lot of harmonies on these songs. So strip back moments like this are a good time, A, to showcase that and to practice that.
You've mentioned the new album, Breaking Into Heaven. It was developed across 3 countries, here in Australia, but France and England as well. How did that kind of transnationalism come about?
The album came about as a result of a project I created, which was called To Be Continued. Selve's an independent band and self-managed and no label or anything like that, doing it all ourselves. So, you know, I had these things. I wanted to, all right, how are we going to make our next record? I'd love to go overseas. But, you know, there's this idea of waiting for the divine hand of the music industry to come and, you know, deliver you. And I was like, I don't want to wait around for that. How can I stand in my sovereignty and make something, just carve my own path and do something epic? And so I created this project, which the idea was to have a 3-stage residency series. And the 3-stage residency series, was the first 2 weeks, Rhys and I went up to my Jabba Jabba country in Broome, and we're spending time on country and with my community and mainly my elders, Uncle Wayne Barker and Arnie Pat Torres. And I write albums very conceptually, so the idea was to get like the first embers of the album and to get the direction of what the album would become, especially because we knew we were going to end up at Abbey Road. So I wanted to ground myself culturally in what I wanted to do with that responsibility of being the first black fella to do an album there. So we started there. and we did get those embers. And then we were in France. We were in France for 8 weeks somewhere called Midnight Special Records, which we had a contact through our previous album, Red Desert Dream. The producer, Simon, was a Parisian fella. And so he linked us up with some people over there. Mm-hmm. And the whole band went over there for 8 weeks. And we spent all that time just writing, creating the album, got up to 25 songs, and then reduced that to 13, which was a paradise in and of itself. And then in the last 2 weeks, we went to Abbey Road and recorded in Studio 3, which is the same room Dark Side of the Moon was done, and Revolver, and all these kind of albums. So the project was double funded through Creative Australia and First Nations Commissioning Fund. So we're super lucky and grateful to get the opportunity to do it. And, you know, the places are relevant because it was country for me. Then France at first was just where we had been connected. But funnily enough, my elder uncle Wayne Barker, who was our mentor for the project, Jabba Jabba Elder, but he also spent 10 years in France as a jazz guitarist playing and touring around. So he had heaps of advice for there. And then Abbey Road was like the final destination. And this idea of activating the world's most famous studio and busting into that place to tell a First Nation story was what made that feel radical. So that was the project. That's what I kind of pitched, and somehow it happened.
What's the influence of being on these different countries and being in these different kind of spaces while creating an album that is First Nations storytelling, First Nations led?
I'd say it was about kind of responding to place, and I think being able to, like, starting is important for my practice to start up on Jabba Jabba country. And we wrote the album's basically like centerpiece song, Forever, which is probably the most important song on the album. And then from that song, all the rest of the songs came out, and it's like quite a emotive, big Floyd-y kind of piano song. And then, you know, around it there are all these rock songs and punk songs and all this kind of stuff, but that's kind of like the hearth. And, you know, so that was really important kind of going into it and being able to just, you know, going overseas. You know, before I created this project, I'd been speaking a lot to Uncle Richard Bell, who is an influence and a mentor and is in our first music video. And we'd previously gone to Germany in the past to document a 15 to do a, I'd done a performance in the tent, his embassy installation. And I'd asked him, you know, what's his advice for any young black fellas trying to make art? And he just said, find the most radical path and follow that. And he also was very passionate about young First Nations artists getting to deliver art, but also absorb art overseas and absorb all of the different conversations, all of the different parallel struggles. And also believed that even in his own career, he felt that when he went overseas, he was appreciated back home more. So that was kind of, you know, and he was just like, go do it, go do all that kind of stuff. And that was like a big inspiration to me. And then I think we did absorb influence from different places, like being in France.
Most definitely.
In a gorgeous place. We went and absorbed like new music that was outside of our, you know, comfort zone. We went to rock and scene.
But just having this, the freedom and the space, like all that time to write songs as well. Like, I mean, first of all, going up to Jabba Jabba country and just feeling so welcomed up there, I guess. And it's so slow and peaceful up there, you know, just that song Forever felt like it was just a gift from the ancestors, like, boom, they have that one. And then, yeah, like having, just a couple of months really in France, like stretching out by the river, you know, in the daytime, and just no feeling of pressure. And I think that just really allowed us to like dive into really what we wanted to do.
And the truth of what Reese is saying there is because, you know, at home, you know, we're all working, you know, we all, you know, have to stay alive. I can't just be like, yo, everyone, do nothing for 8 weeks. We're just going to work on an album. But because we had a grant and, you know, we had our per diems and our accommodation paid for, we had permission to do nothing but work on the album. And that's what I wanted to create. I needed the project support to allow us to have that space. It's one of those things where it's all double mirrors, where that happened because it was overseas and exotic and that kind of thing. So then we were able to just focus on this album for 8 weeks with no distractions, which meant that we were able to go explore so many different genres and sounds and really think about the responsibility of the opportunity of going to Abbey Road and, you know, what message we wanted to send and really throw everything at the wall and find what we really wanted the album to be.
Make mistakes too, like go down pathways that were just in the end like, well, let's leave that one behind. But, you know, just that time to stretch out and enjoy the creative process, I think.
And obviously, as far as how do those places inform the work responsively, like knowing we were going to Abbey Road was a huge part of that, was always there. So we're thinking about that the whole time. And it was this dichotomy of we've grown up loving rock music. So, of course, we've idolized Pink Floyd and the Beatles and all this kind of stuff, and understanding that really hallowed history, and that somehow we as an independent band were going to get to go there and self-produce and have total creative control was wild. So I had that on one hand, but on the other hand, so we're going to be a part of this rock and roll legacy of like 100 years, but I was going up to Jabba Jabba Country and connecting with my culture and understanding of stories and songs that's 60,000 years old. And so it's like, so what's actually more important and what's cooler? And actually, hold on, why are we the first, you know, Aboriginal artist to do a record at Abbey Road? So being able to, you know, balance the awe with a little bit of critical thought. And that's where that quote from Nina Simone kind of came in, which was the people who've built their heaven on your land are telling you that yours is in the sky. And that's what inspired Breaking Into Heaven, because there's, you know, this big pipe dream goal or whatever the music industry is, you know, hovered over our heads to be able to allure us on, confuse and manipulate us. And then there was this idea of here we were getting to go into the middle of London and use their most world famous studio and the best equipment in the world to platform and to tell a First Nation story. And that felt radical and that felt really cool. So that really, the knowledge that, I mean, we got to use John Lennon's piano from Day in the Life and the Mellotron from Strawberry Fields Forever and all that kind of stuff. So there was all the beautiful stuff, but it was also felt like we were breaking in and getting to do something.
I mean, there's just no way, like, all that stuff isn't just, like, blowing your mind out of the water when you first get there. It's, like, it's overwhelming.
Yeah.
But, you know, all of that, you know, bringing all that just that energy and those seeds from, you know, from country, from back here, and knowing why we were there, like, that was the grounding force that I think allowed us to, like, overcome that overwhelm. We were freaking out on the first day, but, like, it's like, no, we've got a job to do here, and this is what, it's important that we're here.
And that knowledge that, you know, we're not there just because we're exceptional or something. We're there because of the path that's been carved before us by the legacy of black artists that go back so far through time, and that we've got an opportunity to lay our stone in the path that's been carved for us for future generations is what grounded us.
It's reminded me of an interview that I heard Wiradjuri poet Jazz Bunny. But Jazz was talking about one of their poems had been published kind of quite early in their writing career and had a moment of like getting excited, obviously, because it is an exciting thing to do, but then also sort of reflecting on why is this the thing that I'm valorizing? Why is like... Not to drag you into that.
No, that's the lens we're coming in as well. But a balance, you know, we're not just totally poo-pooing the awesome opportunity we had to have, but you've got to have a gratitude that we get to have an opportunity that many people would kill for, but also critical enough not to just lose yourself in the sauce and the Kool-Aid of it and just be overly overwhelmed. So I think that it's really important to balance that.
I mean, that said, let's get into the Kool-Aid a little bit. What was it like to be?
tell me about
being at the Abbey Road Studios that first day.
For starters, you have to literally walk across the Abbey Road pedestrian crossing that's on the cover of the album just to get there. So you're doing that every day before you even get there.
Yeah, that was like trying to make itself a normal thing. Yeah. Like by like day 10, we're like, this isn't normal. It's like, oh, we're just walking to work.
Like,
no, we're
like
not.
Dodging the tourists and like, oh, I actually have to get through that gate. Like, sorry. So that was wild. But I mean, yeah, you walk in and it's just history wall to wall, you know, like. I would say, though, that it felt very welcoming. Like, once you're in there, it's like the people who are there treat you as though you deserve to be there. And I think, actually, that a lot of the folk there were quite excited that we were there because it's not very common for bands to come in and record entire albums, like, in one big session like we did that time. Not like they used to do. So, there were folks sort of, like, popping their head in and like, oh, this is cool as a band, you know, making a record. But then in terms of, like, all the gear and all that kind of thing, like, they had the actual desk, the console machine that they used to record Dark Side of the Moon. Just stuff like that you can't really spend too much time thinking about. Otherwise, you're just going to freak out.
I mean, like Thomas Briggs, engineer, came, you know, gave us a tour and he'd be like, yeah, this is where the Beatles did Your Blues. Or Reese, where you're standing, that's where Johnny Greenwood was when they did OK Computer by Radiohead. Yeah. And oh, this is where, yeah, John Lennon played. You can see his cigarette butts in this thing. And, you know, so you're sitting there, and when the first time we went in there, we collapsed on the couch in the room when we first went into Studio 3, because I think the idea suddenly became a reality. You know, it was like it was there, but then, oh, wait, we get to record an album in here? This is so special. Yeah. And, you know, so there was that overwhelm. But I think we did ourselves the favor of being really prepared.
Yeah,
like definitely. Over our 8 weeks in France, we'd written 25, reduced it to the 13, rehearsed them. We were only there for 2 weeks at Abbey Road, basically get up in the morning, get the train, go to studios, go up, eat dinner, go to bed. Yeah. So
it was a song a day every day, like. Yeah, no time to muck around.
So we were, and, you know, because we knew that we wanted for ourselves to do the best possible job, but there's also a responsibility of all those behind us who made it happen. So we wanted to do an epic job. So we felt already really proud of the record and felt really proud and that we did deserve to be there and that we put all of our energy into it. So we went in, but we did absolutely milk every bit of equipment we possibly could. We were sending reverbs up to the roof.
100%, yeah. All the plates in the roof. There was one really special moment where, like I was saying before, once you're inside there, it's like you sort of, you know, if there are people having sessions in other studios, like obviously you can't go in there, but they often just leave the doors open and that kind of thing. So, you know, I was wandering down the hallway one day and just walked past Studio 2, which is like the main one where the Beatles did like 95% of everything they did. And there was no one in there. And there was just this beautiful, big, empty room, except there was just a massive grand piano sitting right in the middle of it. And I just walked down there like, I'm gonna have a little tinkle here, and I played our song Forever. Just got to sit there for a moment completely by myself and just played that into this room. It's hard to describe the magic of a moment like that. So just little things like that. Yeah.
And those feelings, especially of playing like Forever, which is so Forever, which we wrote in Jabba Jabba Country, is the one song that we performed live, not like single tracked, but we recorded it all together. So it was such a special goosebumps moment to know that ember had come all the way from Jabba Jabba Country. And then we were in Abbey Road where all these albums were recorded and that we were getting to perform that in there. And also, you know, I used some Jabba Jabba language in the album. So there's a song called Mabu Walu, which means good fire, and Mabu Wala, which means when fire erupts. And that's like a really, you know, important part of my cultural journey and story. And so to be able to take that piece of language and know that that was being archived in such an important space just had so much goosebumps in being able to do that kind of thing. So it was special because of the awe of the place, but also special because of the awe of what we were bringing to that place and bringing something to that place that it had never had before. And I think that that's a part of what the whole project is about hopefully continuing to carve pathways and showcase that First Nations stories and music deserves to be held in the same esteem as those legacy artists. And, you know, to be able to bust into that space and hopefully create pathways for more mob to be able to get access there is, you know, what it's all about. So it felt special.
Coming back to the new album, Breaking Into Heaven, and the way that it's drawing on that Nina Simone quote, I'm curious about what the other heavens are that are throughout.
Yeah, so it's largely, you know, Breaking Into Heaven, you know, we started with that metaphor of, you know, really breaking into Abbey Road in the most literal sense as this idyllic heaven in music that is an unattainable pipe dream, and wow, we were getting to do it. But then, you know, I started to ruminate on that concept, and it was about kind of, you know, subverting and hopefully overthrowing ideologies that are based on, you know, entitlement and, you know, the idea of the promised land. Has done so much damage the whole world over. Obviously, here in our own country, when you know, the colonizers invaded, it was based on this idea that they were entitled. So this idea of building a heaven on someone else's land then becomes this thing. So, you know, that was the first one, and subverting this idea that, like, sometimes it feels like we have to break into heaven on our own lands, and we already had everything going great before they came. And then, so there are these other ideas. That's the main thing, like subverting that, you know, that's happening here. We're looking at what's happening with Israel and Palestine, and this idea of that they're entitled to the promised land of that place and all the harm and genocide that's coming out of that. And basically, it's the same formula of the colonizer oppressing people and First Nations people all around the world. So, you know, it's not necessarily denying significant religious beliefs or anything like that. It's about this idea of one group of people being entitled to another person's land because of their beliefs. So I want to be kind of clear about that. We're not attacking anyone's belief system. We're attacking a politicized and weaponized version of a belief system. So that whole first kind of chapter is very much about literally breaking into those spaces. You know, if you talk to, you know, a very conservative Christian about what heaven looks like, it's all going to be white. So that song is basically about black fellas breaking into heaven. And you could tell a very conservative person, hey, there is no heaven, and they'll be pretty upset. But, you know, sometimes if you're like, oh, well, you know, what about black fellas in heaven? They'll be, oh, you know, and it's about like, not just denying those stories, but writing ourselves into the stories and that kind of thing. So the first songs interrogate that, breaking into heaven, rapture, and strange romance. And then the second one is, again, about subverting the false heaven of fame and the cult of celebrity and this idea of if I just work hard enough and I get famous and I do X, Y, and Z, then I'm going to be happy. And in the process of doing that, so many of us lose our way, lose our sense of self, our connection to identity, culture, who we are, because we're striving for something that has been externalized and dangled above us. So that whole section is about, but you know, that's a nuanced thing, because any of us who are making art or being creative are entering into that world, and it's a constant balance between that. So it's not just ragging on that kind of thing. It's about exploring the nuance of trying to be an artist, creating something significant while having to be constantly aware of the threat of being compromised. That whole story is about, you know, subverting that false heaven, that false idea. And then the third is kind of like a return, I guess, to what I would say is like, you know, I guess a real heaven or a return. For me, you know, you follow this character who's been, you know, trying to do X, Y, Z, making in Hollywood, and they have it kind of gets to a tragedy by the song of Willem Dafoe, which is almost like the low of that character losing everything and then returning home and finding the wealth of what we already have in our culture, with our communities, being on country. And this kind of that whole end of the album is this really healing. They're the three main things in a nutshell. I could talk about it for ages, that are kind of explored through Breaking Into Heaven.
You're listening to Away, Indigenous Arts and Culture on ABC Radio National. I'm Rudy Bremer, and I'm joined by Lockie Little and Reese Bowden from the alt-rock band Selve. Lockie and Reese have been yarning with me about the band's album Breaking Into Heaven, which was developed on Jubby Jubby Country, refined in Paris, and recorded in London's Abbey Road Studios. But before we dive deeper into the album, I want to know how Lockie and Reese, along with bandmates Creation, Michael, Liam, and Scott, initially came together.
Well, Lockie and I have known each other the longest.
Yep.
We met in primary school. Yep. Lockie was always kind of moving around a lot. I grew up in Gloucester my whole childhood, and Lockie would sort of go away and come back, and he lived in a bunch of different places. But we knew each other through school, and then I knew each other again in high school. And then really we sort of lost contact for about maybe 10 years.
We were nemesis at first.
Right.
Disputes over a shared love interest.
Yeah.
When we were in high school. Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah.
And then we became friends later down the line.
Yeah.
It's like we grew up and like, you know what, you're actually an alright guy.
Yeah. Yeah. We kind of
have
each other
so much in common. You like the same kind of person.
Exactly. Well, that was it. We hadn't seen each other in so many years, and then I was passing through the Gold Coast just randomly one time, and I think we hooked up on Facebook or something like that. So we decided to catch up, and then we had this great jam, and then just good chats, and we're like, yeah, well, you know, let's be friends now. And then I guess there's more to it, but in the end, a couple of years later, I ended up moving up to the Gold Coast, and we started going to uni together and joined the band. I mean, as for the rest of the band, there's been a few different members come and go.
A few iterations. Like the band kind of like started, you know, back in 20. I had like one iteration that just played a couple pub gigs, which is me and a few members who, you know, that didn't last very long. And then, you know, me and our friend Harry Edwards created the first EP, Snake of Light. He's no longer in the band. And then the formation kind of started around that first EP where Reese was in the band. Creation was in the band, and then next to join the band was Michael, our drummer.
Yeah.
So that had been the iteration for a while, but then, you know, a couple shifting members there, and then Liam, our keyboardist, joined the band a year or so later, and then, you know, we had some more shuffles around, and then only in the last 2 years has Scotty, who's our bass player, joined the band. And now we feel like we've finally landed with like our permanent ensemble. But all the members of the band, like Creation and I are partners, we've been together for 9 years. Michael, we met at university.
Yeah.
He was only 19 when he joined the band. He's the baby of the band. And Scotty, we met from Around the Traps. Liam.
Liam just lives nearby.
He just kind of popped in, didn't he?
Local musician in the area. He's got his finger in a lot of pies, that guy.
Yeah, yeah. Life is a Myth is his other artist name.
Yeah.
And then Scotty, who's our bassist and producer, also runs a studio on the Gold Coast called Love Street Studios, and he's just a whiz. So, yeah, and we all live within like a 20-kilometer radius of each other, and we've got our studio at our place, so that's where we rehearse out of. And, yeah, we're all just kind of best friends. And somehow we don't really argue either. That's a fortunate situation.
The location element is incredible. A bit earlier this year I was talking to Chasing Ghosts and they, I think all five of them live in different cities.
Yeah.
And so rehearsing and
so tough.
And actually like creating. Yeah. So it must be really like such a joy to be able to get together and
It is. And there was a while where some of the band was in Brisbane and there was a bit of travelling, but now everyone's kind of really, we're all together on a main nerve and probably spend the most amount of time with each other.
Yeah.
It's like it's a big enough band that it becomes your main friend group.
I'm always kind of curious about the conversation that takes place about the cultural identity of the band itself. How did that conversation kind of go?
Reese and I have been in the band together the longest, and I guess I started Self back in 2019 or 2018. So I've always been the principal songwriter. So all of like the lyrical content and the storytelling is coming from me, if not some support from Reese as well. And then, you know, the rest is kind of musical contributions to help amplify those stories. So I think, you know, all, you know, the band, we're all basically family and really good, you know, great friends, and everyone is super respectful of the direction that Reese and I want to take the stories and the music, and everyone just wants to contribute to help bringing that to its fullest potential. So, I mean, Reese is very multi-instrumental, but I can only play acoustic guitar. There's no way I could get the songs that, or that my stories to the place that they are without the support of my band, who put so much love, blood, sweat, and tears, and have faith in my vision and what I want to try to say.
Yeah.
So I'd say that's kind of how the dynamic works.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, even for me, obviously, we're both First Nations, but the creative vision and the creative drive of the band has always come from Lockie in terms of like those ideas and those stories. And so I think I can speak for myself, but I think I can also speak for the rest of the band when I say that we all feel just incredibly like excited and sort of grateful to be able to, I guess, to have that. Like, we're all good musicians and we really enjoy making music together. But that's only one part of it, you know, when you've got those stories to like sit at the front of it, be the sort of like, you know, that's the arrow that cuts through everything. And that's what gets people really to fall in love with your music. So it's really seamless, and we're all like, we all love each other so much. And
I mean, it's really clear that there is like culture is embedded throughout all that you do as a band. Even looking at your most recent music video released, Leading Man Lost, which stars actor and model Charlie Fraser. How did Charlie become involved?
Well, you know, to loop around to the larger question of the, you know, we treated this as an entire visual campaign. So we were lucky enough to get more funding when we got home. We came home, we had this album from Abbey Road, still completely independent, no management. I was like, all right, how do we get this out into the world? And we were lucky enough to get more funding from the EGC on the Gold Coast to do a big launch show, which was what we did recently, which is the Breaking Into Heaven launch, where we performed the whole album live with a 33-piece Australian session orchestra and had the visuals as a part of that show. So we were able to draw from that to create our music videos. And I collaborated with my co-director, Josh, who was here in the room, who was basically, again, in a situation where they have all the directing knowledge and skills and was very supportive of the cultural stories or the attitudes and the energy that I want to come on, and was it supporting me because it was my first time directing, which was really, really fun. So basically all the stories of the music videos I wrote and conceptualized, and Josh would just dramaturgically help me, you know, make sure. I'd be like, can we do this? And they'd be either be like, yes or no. I was like, can we fly a real plane? And we did end up doing that. So that was kind of the creative process for that. So we kind of wrote them as a whole. And as you said, bringing like the cultural element, I wanted, we'd, you know, had such a big achievement with Breaking Into Heaven being in Abbey Road, and we wanted that to be mirrored in the visuals as well. And so I wanted to make them as deadly as possible and bring in, like, we had cameos from Uncle Richard Bell in Breaking Into Heaven, which was literally about a black fella flying academy, breaking into heaven with a propeller plane. And we had the Coral Dancers, which is Thomas Kelly and those mob from up in the Gold Coast doing some epic dance. And they were, again, in Strange Romance too. So we kind of made all the music videos a bit interconnected. And we wanted to keep having a surprise, you know, in each one. And then Leading Man Lost initially wasn't a single, but then I had this idea where we were thinking about the music videos. I was like, Leading Man Lost, it's a very kind of, you know, big, cool rock song, a bit Arctic Monkeys-esque. It's got a bit of machismo, you know, it's a bit glasses on indoors. And I was getting these visions, you know, I was thinking of Weapon of Choice, you know, with Christopher Walken, like dancing around the big hotel, and then Arctic Monkeys have Tranquility Base Hotel and Casino. But it was this idea, Leading Man Lost. And so I had this idea of for the music video to subvert that egoic idea by having the lead be a strong black female character in a awesome power suit strutting around doing Weapon of Choice. And because that's such like a music video formula that you see that idea repeated, but it's always a dude, you know? And so I wanted to just, I don't know, change that up. And I had this thought, I'd never met Charlie before. I was just like, what, Charlie Fraser, that would be iconic. Well, all right, impossible things keep happening. You know, I got to Abbey Road. Let's just ask. And reached out to Charlie, who we've become great friends with now. And I had drawn up a pitch deck, put it, you know, tried to make it profesh. And we sent a, you know, an email out to Dolly, her agent, and her. And then they were like, hey, this is really cool. Let's organize a meeting. And I kind of was like, all right, I've got to pick it up, put on my big boy pants and pitch this as well as I can, you know, in this meeting. And then they got on and Charlie was like, I love this idea. I listened to the whole album. I love the song. I love everything that it's about. Like, let's make this happen. And then, so yeah, basically we did make it happen. Charlie came over from LA and we filmed it on the Gold Coast in the Star Casino. And it was actually, Charlie was also able to source these Carla Zampani, I think is the name of the suit. Like her own power suits. And you know, so she just rocked up with like 20 options for us. We're just like, oh my god. She, I think, you know, she loves collaborating with mob, and when she is dedicated to a project, she like goes all in. Like, we were so overwhelmed by the level of detail she'd put into listening to the music, and we had really big yarns about what the song was about, and I kind of sent her the kind of treatise of the album so she could understand, because she really likes to get into the character. And the album is you know, almost written theatrically. There is like three parts. There's like part one, which is a subversion of kind of dogmatic religious ideas, as in it's about interrogating false heavens. So there's dogmatic, you know, religious ideas. And then there is like the cult of celebrity and that kind of Americanized Hollywood thing that, you know, is also used. And then the third act is kind of like a return to culture, community, and self. And so Leading Man Lost comes from the back. That whole series is called The Rise and Fall of Romeo Jones, and is almost conceptually about a black actor who goes over to LA and is doing some great movies, but then is far away from their people and the community and starts losing their center of gravity and identity and integrity and all this, and is really struggling between living between their dreams and who they are. And so I'd kind of sent Charlie this whole thing about that, and then Charlie was like, did you write this for me? Because this is really aligning with what I'm feeling at the moment. And I was like, oh yeah, you're a black actress living in LA. And I didn't even think about that. That was, this character was similar to you. So she was like, this really resonates with me. I think this has come to me at the right time in my life. So there was a lot of love and authenticity that Charlie was able to bring to the role, because we were able to connect as peers and black fellas, you know, going through similar experiences. And then so she just came and just rocked it out of the park. And she's such a talent and such a beautiful human being who really cares about art. And so, yeah, she's, yeah, in Leading Man Lost, basically the plot is that she kills me and steals the band and becomes the front person. So, and you know what? Selves never looked better. Yep. And,
great. That's good.
So yeah, we had a lot of fun and have so much gratitude, to Charlie for getting involved so deeply. And now we're all lifelong pals.
Obviously, the album has only just come out, but you have started to perform it for audiences. Have there been any surprises or anything that's kind of...
I mean, well, we hadn't played any gig all year, and then our first gig was the Breaking Into Heaven launch show with the 33-piece orchestra. So we kind of like really came out of the gates. And I think we were just really... really stoked and excited that we were able to sell that show out. We had like 700 people, which is our biggest audience ever. And we were only playing the album. So no old songs or anything like that. And the response that we got was really, really overwhelmingly beautiful. And that was just really validating, you know, because we've worked on this for like a whole year and poured all of ourselves into it. So just to know that the music is connecting to people is amazing.
Yeah.
Any other things for you?
Yeah, I guess just that chance to show an audience in that orchestra show like what the scope of what we tried to do, because I feel like, you know, obviously we're like putting Friday Night out as a single here. Like we made that decision because we felt like we wanted to represent that tender part of the album, because before that was a lot of high energy going on.
Yeah.
And the first half of that show is much the same, like all the energy's up front, and then getting into the second half of that and really getting down into those tender moments and feeling, yeah, just getting the love back, I guess, from people taking that in, and yeah, just I guess having that opportunity to express the breadth of what we've tried to do. That was really beautiful.
Yeah, I think it's affirming that, like, you know, in our creative practice, we really tried when we were in France to surprise ourselves every day, because my Uncle Wayne Barker had a provocation, which was, what are you risking? Mm-hmm. If you're making music or playing music and you don't feel like you're risking something, then you're not putting your skin in the game. And I was like, okay, so we might write like a big radical punk song like Natural Born Killer, and that felt risky because it's angry and it's got rage. And then it's like, okay, we did that. Now let's do a really acoustic, vulnerable song, because that feels like risking something. That feels hard. Mm. And it's like, oh, let's do an EDM song, because we haven't done that before. That's going to be tricky. How do we do that? And then it's like, oh, okay, let's make a pop song that's almost very surface and filled with love, because the us that wrote that punk song would be like sneering at this song, like, what's this? So that's why we have to do it. Mm. So we took a lot of left turns in the album and crossed a lot of terrain, but I think we still tried to make it very cohesive with the track list. And I guess it's validating to know that people are feeling that, experiencing that range, and that it doesn't just feel random. Yeah. You know what I mean? That we can go from having a big post-punk song to wheeling out the Steinway on stage and having a tearjerker going on as well. Yeah. So that's been validating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess as far as, being on the road too, like that sort of is only really just starting, I guess.
Yeah.
For the rest of the year, we're going to be playing a lot of shows. So
we'll find out.
Remains to be seen.
So much more to come.
Yeah.
You've got one more song that you're going to be playing for us. Tell me about Friday Night.
From my perspective, it was a hard one to get out in the studio. It was one where we started it and it was feeling nice, and then I just couldn't figure out like what to put on it in terms of my guitars and that kind of thing. It took a little bit of figuring out, but then once it existed, it very quickly became a lot of our favorites. And it's just, what is it about?
Yeah, Friday Night, it's a really kind of beautiful song. Again, we put that as a single is because it feels like it represents the body of, like, you know, four or five songs in the album that are really soft and gentle and are about healing, or from that third act. Like I'm saying, a lot of our singles are from the start, which is all rock and EDM and play, and it's a bit cool and epic. And then that second half of the album's all very vulnerable. And Friday Night's probably the most up-tempo of those kind of vulnerable songs. But it's definitely about, you know, it was a song that I've had for years and was written while going through a bit of a hard time and kind of being like on the edge. And it's kind of like a post-nihilistic anthem, I'd say. Like the chorus is like, if nothing matters, then why do you matter to me? And it's about when you're in that time where, you know, if you're feeling depressed, like nothing matters. And we've all kind of been in that kind of place, and it can make you just bum out on the whole world. And then, but there can just be a simple act of the most human love, not something profound or a big revelation, but just caring for anyone else or anyone caring for you. I feel like I debunked that idea. If we really feel that nothing matters, then why do you matter to me? And it's just it's a question to pose to myself, to other people. And so it felt, I feel like there's a lot of healing in the song. There's a lot of beauty in the song, and there's a lot of love in this song. Because I've been talking a lot about the, I guess, the subversive and the radical side of the album, which is there, but there's, you know, something extremely subversive and radical about love and black joy and, yeah, and all that kind of stuff as well. So this song is definitely about that. And there is a lot of tenderness in the album. Despite the name Breaking Into Heaven, you know, it becomes an extremely tender, sensitive and heartfelt kind of thing. So it's really important. We really love sharing this song because I think it's one of our most beautiful ones.
Mm.
Yeah.
One, two, one, two.
If nothing matters, then why do you matter to me? If nothing matters, then why do you matter to me? Skies, last in the world for a sacrifice. Call me in the morning from the other side. It was me and my boy nearly every night. Popping on the bonnet, baby, Jesus Christ. Couldn't stop us if we wanted, baby, you and I. Found our own salvation on the other side. She grabbed my face and said, if nothing matters, then why do you matter to me? If nothing matters, then why do you matter to me? If nothing matters, then why do you matter to me? If nothing matters, then why do you matter to me? If nothing matters, then why do you matter to me? If nothing matters, then why
That was alt-rock band Selve, live in the Radio National Studios for Away. The song was Friday Night and comes from their latest album, Breaking Into Heaven, which is available to buy or stream now. Or you might like to catch them live yourself. To stay up to date with what Selve are up to in 2026, head to selvemusic.com. I'll also put a link on Away's show page for you. You're listening to Away on Radio National, and it's time now for Word Up. This week, we're hearing from language champion Dr. Jesse Hodgetts. He's sharing a little more of his Nyampa dialect, Wangaipun. Today's word has a special meaning for Jesse. It's one that refers to the bark ribbon on a gum tree. And it's also the name of his 3.5-year-old son.
Pukulba means happy.
Word Up, bringing you the diverse languages of Black Australia, one word at a time.
Kinagai.
Birluin.
Walter.
Kalang.
Badjili.
Ngalungir.
Bambach.
Jiangye.
Injamara.
Guram.
Mijal.
Raipiri.
Ngaraguche nama.
Gani warangung.
Munyip.
Domaninialka. Wakaniniana.
Wardadawiya.
Ngundingi dangan.
Wukuk.
Kuwayu.
Delkup.
Tiepa.
Murupuk.
I'm Jesse Hodgetts. I'm a Wangaipun, Nyampa and Wiradjuri Mei. That's the languages of my ancestors. And Dakanung country is the country that I'm speaking from today and the country that I was born and raised. And Dakanung is also what I call my Ngurumba, my home and country that I'm also responsible to. My next word is walu. Walu is a bark ribbon that is hanging on a gum tree before it drops. You'll see it usually happen when it gets a bit warmer, when the trees want to shed their bark. I learnt that word from the archives, from an important old fella named Archie King, who referred to it in a song about the red-breast robin, when he said, in the song, it's Dunloko Nga Gara Nga Walongko Loigara. And that means the red-breast robin's tail is moving along like a bark ribbon in the wind. And that bark ribbon, that walu, you know, it'll fall to the ground. It'll support the tree. You know, it keeps moisture in the ground, nutrients in the ground. It'll be used to burn the ground rather than the fire getting up the tree. So it teaches us, if I can cycle back to Warana, teaches us about the trees being living in Warana, and they're clever too, and they teach us about our life cycle as well. And Walu is the name of my son. So that's his story. I can see Walu, my son, connecting and interacting with the world through a cultural way because he is a Walu. I can see the way he connects to the bush turkeys, the Nguruin, the way a Walu does. So I can already see how important it is that we're living our language, we're naming our children in language, and we're enacting that responsibility, and that they can just grow up into it as normal and don't have to do that painstaking work of reading through the colonizers' archives like we do. He can just grow up knowing he's Walu, that's who he is, he is country. Ngaya katono means I'll see you later, not goodbye, I'll see you later. And that's that's not a word I grew up hearing, it's just a word I saw recorded by the old people in the archives. Ngaya katono, I'll see you later.
Word Up, bringing you the diverse languages of Black Australia, one word at a time.
That was Dr. Jesse Hodgetts sharing some more of his Nyampa dialect, Wangaipun. You can catch the full series of Word Up on the ABC Listen app. And that's our show for this week. Thanks for your company. Away was produced on Gadigal Country. Our technical producer is Simon Branthwaite. We'll be back next week, but in the meantime, you can always find us on the ABC Listen app, along with our Titter program Speaking Out, hosted by Larissa Berendt. Until next time, I'm Rudy Bremer. Yalu.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.